In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. In our last interview with media theorist and author Douglas Rushkoff, we looked at how humans have unwittingly become the product. Unwittingly because the design of the technology to meaningfully connect people is a parasite masquerading as something beneficial. In reality, most big tech social media software was designed to create addiction and ultimately stays true with profiting through the centuries-old expansionist economic system. Big tech extracts money from the marketplace, but then stores it as share price. Land and labor are devalued and missing from the basic factors of production, leaving capital as the one goal for shareholders. This is the dominant system that flourishes in the emerging digital industry. These concepts are part of what Douglas Rushkoff distills in the book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. It was published in 2013 before his book, Team Human. Rushkoff asks, what happened to the opportunity to innovate and reinvigorate economic and business models with new digital tools that might promise to usher in an era of distributed prosperity? Instead, something similar to a digital colonialism has been created. As corporations dominate the digital economic landscape and most people are keeping pace to survive, algorithms are killing jobs. More than two-thirds of job loss is from being replaced by a machine. There are other nefarious practices conducted by big tech that have impacted the democratic process and basic civil rights. Those practices include censorship and vote manipulation. For example, big tech monopolies such as Google, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter have been exposed in their effort to subversively deplatform and censor political perspectives without much opposition. In his written testimony before the U.S. Senate Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Dr. Robert Epstein, a senior research psychologist with the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology, wrote, quote, "To let big tech companies get away with invisible manipulation on the scale would be to abandon the free and fair election, a cornerstone of democracy. It would make democracy meaningless even if your chosen candidate prevailed." Our guest, author Douglas Rushkoff, is also a broadcaster. He hosts the podcast Team Human and has written 20 books, including Present Shock, Media Virus, Team Human, and Siberia. Rushkoff has originated concepts such as viral media and social currency. He is also the leading voice for applying digital media toward social and economic justice. Douglas Rushkoff, welcome back to Another News.
Hey, good to be with you.
Well, thanks for doing this because your focus is on Team Human right now, but this book lays out the foundation of an inherent operating system flaw in the digital industry. You started with describing the growth trap in digital industrialism. That's interesting to me because when I was a radio reporter in Florida 20 years ago, there were many reports on the Florida economy that criticized its growth based economy that created urban sprawl and then the wealth wasn't evenly distributed. You've written that, quote, "It's a new environment, but an old growth agenda."
You know, the interesting thing is that the Miami economy of 20 years ago, the reason why it was growing so fast is because they had to launder all the cocaine money that was coming in, right? So all that money was coming in looking for a place to hide. And it went into real estate. I mean, they ended up with all this cash. Where do we put it? And it's interesting because the digital economy is kind of similar. They're these hedge fund billionaire VCs desperate for places to put their money where they can get, you know, 100x or 1000x return. So in some ways, the excesses of the digital economy are the exact same problem. There's this money coming in that's demanding that it get cleaned and that it grow. And these digital companies, instead of serving the people that their apps may have been invented to serve, they have to end up, you know, twisting themselves into knots in order to deliver back capital.
In your book, you've explored the growth economy trap using Twitter as an example and how it's based on the number of people reached, and that includes robots. Could you talk about the nature of this trap, optimizing platforms for growth, and in terms of the pressure from shareholders?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's depends how far back into the story you want to go. Most of the people running digital companies, they're aware of the particular operating systems they want to disrupt, the particular market, whether it's the books market or the taxi cab market. They understand that, but they don't challenge the operating system on which their businesses are running. So for me, it was when it became clear was when I saw Evan Williams, who is a friend of mine, the founder of Twitter, or one of the founders of Twitter, and he was on the cover of the Wall Street Journal with the number 4.3 billion under his face, which was how much he had earned the morning of Twitter's IPO. That's the day that Twitter stock was being sold on the market, meaning the day they sold their company to the public markets. And I looked at that number under him, and I thought, on the one hand, I was really happy that this friend of mine was now a billionaire, just because it's kind of cool to know someone who's a billionaire. But at the same time, I thought, you know, poor Evan, this guy's screwed, because now he has to somehow return 100 times $4.3 billion to all these people, you know, and more than that, because there are other investors who made money. So how is he going to do that without destroying Twitter? And he can't. You know, Twitter peaked out at about $2 billion a year. And once it made $2 billion a year for a sort of 1 or 2 years running, you know, Wall Street considered it an abject failure. You know, that here's this company that with a 140-character messaging app is making $2 billion a year, but it can't seem to make more than that. You know, in other words, the investors, they're not happy with a regular return. What they want to do is buy stock and then sell that stock with great capital gains, with the stock being worth more than it was when they bought it. That's the way they make their money. So the company just has to grow by any means necessary. It has to pay back more money than it got from its investors, and not by giving them regular returns or dividends, but by giving them a way of selling what they have. Really, that's the way the mob goes into a bar or a restaurant. You know, they just use the bar. They use, in this case, the digital company as a front for the growth of capital. And that's not the way you run a business. It's not, you know, how Joe's Pizzeria works. Joe's Pizzeria makes a profit on every pizza, and then they live off those profits and reinvest some of them in the business. This is something entirely different. This is, I want to make 100 times the money I put in within 18 months of my investment. And you're going to do that by burning your friggin' company into the ground.
Right. By any means necessary. I think that's really important for clients of Twitter to understand.
Yeah. I mean, different people in different amounts. But yeah, the way, as we all know now, and I've been screaming about for 20 years, you know, the way these companies make money is not by selling services to you and me. It's by selling you and me to market researchers. We pay with our data. You know, that's paying with yourself. When you use Facebook, what's really going on there is not, you know, Mark Zuckerberg helping you make and maintain friendships. What Facebook is doing is monetizing your social graph, right? Their business plan is to use the data that you leave behind in order to put you in a statistical bucket and figure out with about 80% accuracy what you're going to do next, and then fill your news feed with articles and pictures and recommendations that make sure that you behave true to your statistical profile. So if I know, say, with, you know, 80% accuracy that if they know that I'm going to go on a diet, say, in the next 6 weeks, once they know that with about 80% accuracy, they start filling my news feed with, you know, diet messaging and pictures of what happens to your bloodstream when you eat too much fat and all that. They're not just doing that to sell a particular client's product to me. What they're doing is trying to get that 80% accuracy up to 90% or 95%. They want to get those 20% of people who are going to do something different and make sure that they go on the diet, that they do the thing that they were predicted to do. So what they're doing is really they're shaving off the 20% of people who are going to do something original or different, some anomalous behavior. And at a time when we need new solutions, when we need more innovation, when we need more weirdness, not less, if we want to solve our global problems, it's a particularly dangerous moment to take a multi-trillion-dollar industry and turn it entirely towards reducing human unpredictability, you know, entirely toward trying to get us to behave true to our statistical profiles.
It is rather convenient, I agree, to reduce spontaneity in the millions of people addicted to these social media apps. And so, unsuppressed, healthy economic systems can threaten a power structure. You've written about how removing humans from the equation started with mass production, and the Industrial Revolution was the response from the aristocracy to take back power from the lower class. Would you talk more about this to outline an important background here for listeners, please?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an old story, but it's still pretty interesting because it keeps hitting us back today. And I think the seeds for our deliverance are kind of within this story. So yeah, it was right after the Crusades in the late Middle Ages that Western Europeans had opened up all these trade routes, you know, mostly with Moorish countries, but also with one another. And, you know, the soldiers got back from the wars, and they copied this innovation they'd seen in Arab countries called the bazaar, which we called the market. And what they did was they created these little markets outside each town, each city, where people would trade goods with each other. And, you know, as they realized barter wasn't really up to the task of allowing everybody to trade with everybody else, they used what they saw in the bazaar, which was something called market money. So there were these like poker chips that were sort of issued in the morning. You could get poker chips for your various commodities or issue them yourself. And those were really optimized for transaction. You'd get these little tokens that, you know, maybe they would be good for the course of the day and they would expire in the evening. So people would really be motivated to spend them, you know, rather than be stuck with them at the end of the day. And the problem was, is people did all of this peer-to-peer trading with these local monies that were really cheap and easy and disposable. Human beings, the peasants got wealthy. The peasants became the middle class. And as the peasants got wealthy, the aristocracy got relatively poorer. So they came up with these two ideas to really prevent the poor from getting any more wealthy. The first one was central currency. And they said that you're not allowed to issue these market monies anymore. If you want to trade with each other, now you've got to borrow currency from the central treasury at interest. So if you borrow $100 in order to do transactions, you're going to have to pay back $200, you know, by the end of the month. And where does that extra money come from? Well, it comes from growth. That's why we have a growth-based economy. We all borrow money in order to transact. We all have to borrow it from the central bank at interest, although right now the interest rate is very low because most of us aren't even allowed to borrow money anyway. But, you know, the operating system of our economy is that you borrow money at interest, you pay back more than you borrowed, which means you've got to grow somehow from somewhere, either at someone else's expense or by expanding into other nations, other areas at their expense, and get territories. That's how colonialism worked. It's why we had to go invade South America and North America and Africa and take all their resources and enslave their people. It's because our economy had to grow in order to pay back the king and the central treasury all the money that was borrowed. And the second great innovation they came up with that the aristocracy invented at the same moment in the late Middle Ages was the chartered monopoly, or what we now call the corporation. A chartered monopoly, just like it sounds, is a business that's allowed to do business because they have a charter from the king. So Joe gets a monopoly in shoemaking, and Mary gets a monopoly in traveling to the East Indies, and someone else gets a monopoly in jams. You still see it sometimes, you know, on a tea or on a jam, you know, Her Majesty's Royal Jammery or whatever. It doesn't mean that the Queen just buys her jam there. It means that that's the person that had the original chartered monopoly on jam or on tea or on bread. And that changed the whole landscape. Instead of being able to work for a living, now you had to go become an employee and sell your time. So you weren't allowed to be in the shoe business or in the jam business. You had to be an employee of His Majesty's Royal Shoe Company or Jam Company. And now instead of selling the value you created, now you sold your time as a wage earner. That's the same moment they put the clock up on the tower in the medieval town, because the idea was that, well, we all know that an hour is an hour, and this clock will prove that that hour was fairly, fairly determined. But it's only making an unfair system look fair, because no one's allowed to be in business unless you're a friend of the king. And now everybody's relegated to an employee. And we live in this world now where we all understand the world is, well, you have to get a job. You have to work for someone. You work for the man. And it's harder than ever to create your own small business, because these spaces are entirely dictated by regulators who are, you know, in with the same corporations that you were hoping to compete with.
Right. People do start their own business, and the success rate is marginal. But then you take this and connect it with what's going on now with the digital industry. And this is the expansionist economic system, you point out. Digital industry is basically digital colonialism.
I mean, right, or even digital industrialism. You know, most of us like to think of the industrial age as this time when we developed all these technologies so that we could make things faster and better and reach more people and all. But really, the industrial age was about removing human beings from the value chain. It was so that you wouldn't have to hire a skilled craftsperson to make something. You would just, you know, go to the Home Depot parking lot and find someone you could pay 25 cents an hour to nail, you know, one nail on the bottom of a shoe, rather than hiring a skilled craftsperson. So the industrial age, the assembly line and mechanics and all, was really about making it so that you wouldn't have to pay your workers, so that they wouldn't have any power over you. If you look at kind of the history of these companies from, you know, British East India Trading Company back, you know, in the Renaissance, going out and colonizing places and not letting natives create any value. I mean, that's largely why we had the American Revolution, that the, you know, British East India Trading Company said that, you know, we were not allowed to do anything but grow cotton. You know, we couldn't turn the cotton into fabric. We couldn't turn the fabric into clothes. We could grow cotton as a commodity crop, and then we had to put it in bushels and sell it to the British East India Trading Company at prices that were already set, prearranged prices. They would then take all that cotton all the way over to England, turn it into fabric, turn it into clothes, and then ship it all the way back to us, where we had to buy it again at set prices, because we weren't allowed to do what's called, you know, we weren't allowed to add value, because that would have given us some power. That would have given us, you know, salaries. It would have helped us develop. And that's, you know, true today, even when, you know, when the World Bank lends money to a country in Africa, you know, they're allowed to pay it back with their resources, with their gold, with their coltan, with the rare earth metals, but they're not allowed to make the chips. You know, no. It's, you know, it's Intel or whatever other company that gets to actually fabricate this stuff and get the way majority of the value. You know, the 10x or the 100x value on that thing comes from turning it into something, not just digging it out of the ground. That's the poorest person, it does that part of it. But then, as you see, you know, we went forward from the British East India Trading Company to, say, Walmart, which has the same basic business model. You go to a territory, extract all the value you can from these people, even if you're paying them less than they were making before you got there. You know, a Walmart comes to a town, and the net effect is the town gets poorer, not richer, because all of the local businesses have been driven out of business by Walmart's artificially low prices. And then once Walmart's the sole employer in the town, they can hire everybody on part-time, not give anybody benefits. So more people end up going on welfare. The net effect is negative until eventually the town goes bankrupt and the Walmart closes and moves on to the next one. And that's really the same philosophy that Amazon and Uber and the other digital companies are taking, only they can bankrupt a market in, 18 months instead of 18 years. Uber goes in, finds a town and it either, bribes or hoodwinks local authorities into letting them really destroy the thriving, even if it's not as efficient, taxi industry in a town. And they wipe out everybody's jobs. So you end up, driving a car for less than minimum wage or sometimes at a loss, as a lot of people at Uber and Lyft are finding out. And the business that actually paid people a livable wage goes away. And consumers just go to whatever seems the cheapest at the moment without realizing the long-term cost for making their decisions like that. Amazon, by being so extreme, it's killing the big box stores, those big monopolies, but it may become kind of the only monopoly, and it could end up, and this is a big could, a big if, but it could end up actually creating more space for local businesses. So as it puts like the Blockbusters and the Barnes and Nobles and these Best Buy or whatever, all those things out of business, then there's room for your, where do you get things when you do want there to be another human being at the store where you want to touch the thing or try it out. So I'll be interested to see in the long term if all those middle-sized big box store players go away and you're just left with sort of one Amazon at the top and then a million mom-and-pop stores for everything else.
That's a silver lining, in a way.
It could be. It's just hard to have pity for a Barnes & Noble. I remember when they were putting all the small bookstores out of business, we hated them. And it's like now that Amazon's putting them out of business, we're supposed to be on Barnes & Noble's side. It's like, no, these are the corporate wars. These are giant shareholder-owned corporations that don't really mean any of us any good. So it's hard to have pity for the smaller of the behemoths.
And you're talking about the publishing industry in particular, which it was quite vulnerable as an industry for something like Amazon to scoop up.
Yeah, well, they pick. The digital companies don't care about the actual verticals that they're in. They pick a vertical, and vertical just means like an area, like books or taxi cabs. They pick a vertical that is inefficiently run. They pick low-hanging fruit. The book industry was not a growth area. It's not. There's only so many people in the world and so much reading time, and books were never a growth industry. I've been involved in books since the 80s. We've always been just kind of stumbling along. But the fact that we're stumbling along, makes us a prime target for a company like Amazon. The fact that the taxi cab business has always been around but always kind of stumbling along made them a prime target for, a digital disruptor to come in and take them over. It would be much harder for a digital business to come and disrupt the oil industry, or Monsanto or something. One of these, powerhouse industries that still has lobbying and power. But taxis, books, they were the low-hanging fruit for a digital disruptor, and they were just used. They're just being used as kind of a beachhead in a bigger war. Amazon never thought it would make money from books. It could establish a monopoly in the book industry that then it could leverage to move into all of retail or into cloud services or into Prime and all the other kinds of things they're doing.
Another industry that was disrupted was the music industry, and you go into real great detail about the power law dynamics, for example, selling music on digital platforms. Can you expound on that for listeners, please?
Yeah, well, in the digital media environment and the digital economic environment, you end up with a kind of a winner-takes-all phenomenon. It's kind of like a poker game happening really fast where one guy is going to end up with all the chips at the table. You know, it's kind of the way our economy works, but when you turbocharge it on digital, these effects get more extreme. So, yeah, you take something like music. You know, thanks to digital technology, more people have more access to, you know, writing and creating music, and they can upload their files onto iTunes or Pandora, wherever they want. And you would think that would mean a more democratized, egalitarian music industry. But contrary to that expectation, this idea of a long tail with many, many different people, what we've got is the opposite, that thanks to the way digital technology sorts and reinforces certain artists, we've ended up with fewer people making a living making music. You know, so there's a few billionaires and everybody else sells one record or nothing. So there's actually fewer successful musicians now than there were back in the days of records. And partly that's because there's less diversity. You have Clear Channel owning most of the radio stations, playing the same, really the same hits list on all different kinds of stations, wanting more and more crossover, more and more, you know, so they don't have to play or learn or buy even as much music. They don't want to play variety. They want to limit the choice. You know, likewise, if you have everybody going to a different record store in their town, then the person who owns that record store is going to be playing different records while you're in there and shopping. They're either, because each one has different taste. When you're using iTunes and there's a leaderboard of here's the top 10 or top 50 records, you know, then that ends up being self-reinforcing. You see those top 10, and then you buy from those top 10, and that keeps that 10 on the top 10 even longer. So you end up with one Taylor Swift and a billion that are never even played. People should understand that the same thing then happens with stocks, with algorithms, with everything else. You end up with these power law dynamics, which is what makes a single Uber into a giant. Overnight, there's all of these self-reinforcing feedback loops that allow the one that's starting to win to go all the way really quickly. And with power law dynamics, when everybody's plugged into the same Facebook and the same this and the same that, it oddly enough, when it's, you know, fewer corporations own more media now than 20 years ago, and it was already just five or six companies 20 years ago. So the fewer companies that own it, the less variety you actually get. You know, even if there's, you know, 20 different chatting pieces of software, they're all owned by Facebook. So it's one company.
What steps would you suggest to get out of a growth-based digital marketing industry and into non-growth models?
Well, in marketing in particular, or you mean in the whole economy?
In marketing in particular.
Well, marketing is a hard one, since marketing exists to, right now, to get people to buy stuff that they don't really need. You know, it's really part of a whole, our economy is in a bit of a problem now. So, you know, I guess most people look at it as the problem is that there's not enough jobs, that we're going to need more, we need more employment. But we're not looking at jobs from the perspective of we need more people on board doing work. Right, that was the original purpose of jobs or work, is to get stuff done. But right now, you know, we're tearing down houses in California because they're going into foreclosure because no one can afford them. We're burning food every week in America because it's a surplus. But we can't just give the hungry people that food. We can't just let people, homeless people, live in those houses. You know, and why is that? It's because they don't have jobs. So jobs are not a way for people to provide value to the economy. Jobs are a way for us to justify letting people participate in the spoils of the economy. And since we don't have enough jobs, what we do is we come up with some, you know, plastic doodad that nobody really wants, but we, you know, get a bank to lend money to a company to build a factory to make these plastic pieces of crap that nobody really wants, and that they're just going to stick in a storage unit or in the garbage eventually anyway. But then we need marketers. And what the marketers are for is to convince people to buy those things that they don't really want. I would think that's got to be a painful job for anybody, you know, to go into marketing in that sort of way. But, you know, really what we got to do is look at how do we pivot the economy away from growth-based solutions and toward more circulatory ones? How do we reward people that are actually providing goods and services to other people and punish those who are just, you know, growing companies and disposing of them as if they were just like matchsticks? And I don't think that's impossible. I think the way we do that is, I mean, you could do it through tax policy. You know, right now we reward capital gains with really low taxes, and we punish dividends, revenue, and payroll with really high taxes. That's what they mean when they say the billionaires aren't paying any tax and all the poor people are. It's because our tax rates, meaning anybody really who's less than a millionaire, our tax rates, we pay on the money we earn. You know, billionaires, they're not earning money. They make money with their money. They make their money on the interest or on the stock growth. So they want their stocks to grow by any means necessary because they're only taxed a teeny little bit. If we reverse that and had, you know, they pay high tax on capital gains, but we pay low tax on actual income that we worked for, then all of a sudden their view is going to change. Then they're going to say, oh, wait a minute, I want my company to actually have revenue. I want it to actually create value. I want to be selling something rather than just selling the stock of this company. You know, and that moves us out of this abstract, extractive economy, the one that looks at each business the way the mob looks at the bar that it owns, and instead, you know, we'll look at it in terms of, do people want to come to this bar? Are they going to buy our drinks? Are they having a good time? Are they going to come back? You know, which is a very different approach. You know, another way to look at it is something that the popes came up with, and right after Marx, actually, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, they came up with something called distributism. And what they were arguing was that, you know, not to do socialism, it's not a matter of redistributing the spoils of capitalism after the fact. What we've got to do is start pre-distributing the means of production before the fact. So what would a digital economy look like if the workers owned the tools that they were using? If the taxi drivers for Uber owned Uber, if they were the shareholders rather than just the exploited labor force, you know, what would that look like? You know, and that's what we call a platform cooperative. And that's something else we can move into that digital technology is really good at, is figuring out who did what, who owes what to whom, and why, you know, to create companies that have shared ownership structures. Now that, again, that changes the game. So it's not some shareholder in New York who's controlling a company that, you know, tons of people in Cleveland are working in. Instead, it's we, the Cleveland workers, own this company. What do we want it to do? What kind of impact do we want it to have on our own community? And how do we want to share in the money this company makes? You know, and that's not rocket science. That's not utopianism. That's just sort of basic business.
Our guest is Douglas Rushkoff, author of the not-so-recently published book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity. And your recent book, Douglas, is titled Team Human, but we've talked about that in a previous show, but we're looking at this particular book because it is a very in-depth foundation, I think, for Team Human.
This book, finally, book Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, mm-hmm. Which I published in 2013, it's finally made it up now. You know, I just got invited last month. I spoke at Bretton Woods, which is this conference where it's the conference right after World War II, where they came up with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. It's when they decided to peg all the global currencies on the dollar. And, you know, so here's like billionaires and the head of the World Bank and the head of the IMF coming together in New Hampshire, you know, 2 weeks ago, mm-hmm. and inviting me to come talk about exactly what we're talking about. They're finally at the place where they realize, oh my gosh, we've got to turn this economy away from where it's at and find a new answer. And they found the book, you know, they went, oh my gosh, he's saying how to do this, how to move us from, you know, this digital industrialism, this highly extractive, basically it's traditional capitalism on digital steroids, which is going to kill us all if we don't stop it pretty soon. And how do we move towards something more distributed, something that has a more of a distributed prosperity to it? And they are willing. You know, they're willing. I was delightfully surprised at how willing these people are, because they realize the only other option is we all die. You know, they can't build shelters with walls tall enough, you know, to protect them against the billions of starving people, you know, that they'll create if they don't change their economic practices. So, you know, what I'm talking about is not kind of pie-in-the-sky utopianism. These are, you know, concrete steps that even make sense to bankers. So we're not maybe in as bad shape as we've been fearing.
Facebook, YouTube, and Google are involved with nightmare-level ethical scandals. For example, Facebook's Cambridge Analytica data mining and voter manipulation. Whistleblowers coming forward exposing Google's censorship of many political perspectives. Hidden camera interviews of YouTube employees exposing intentional censorship and shadow banning by Project Veritas, who brought it to the public domain, and much more. Political leanings aside, no private company should have either the right or the power to manipulate large populations without their knowledge. Dr. Robert Epstein, in his testimony to Congress, wrote that it's not only conservative content getting censored. Google censors progressive and socialist content, and he writes the problem with Google is not that it censors conservatives. The problem is that it has the power to determine what content billions of people worldwide will or will not see. No single entity, especially a private company that's not accountable to the public, should have that power. And here are a few recent headlines. Insider blows whistle and executive reveals Google plan to, quote, prevent Trump situation in 2020. That was on a hidden camera. Another headline reads, Google is bent on never letting somebody like Donald Trump come to power again. What many people don't realize is a lot of money helping the Google Facebook startup companies came from CIA-connected venture capitalist NQTEL. Would you please talk about that connection and how digital corporations could be considered parasitic entities subverting and disrupting what's left of democratic systems?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's kind of two different stories we're talking about here. I mean, one is that, yeah, when the U.S. government security funded Google early on, and that's because they realized this would be a great way, you know, instead of having to spy on people, we're just get everybody's data. They're just going to give it to us. And if Google sort of had the best chance of becoming the world's information company, the government decided, well, look, we will let you carry on in an unregulated and unmolested way if you give us backdoor access to everything. You know, when they sent Eric Schmidt over there, I think that was the moment, you know, when they found their guy, you know, a trusted friend of, let's just call it the state, and get him in there with these two Stanford kids and make sure that they create a company that we can use. So there was that, and that's all the sort of, you know, Ed Snowden sort of discovered kinds of stuff, that what the NSA is doing through the companies that it at least in part controls. The other problem is less conscious and maybe more pernicious, and that's, you know, algorithmic recommendations, mm-hmm. that the way, you know, the Google search returns that you get are going to be different than the search returns that I get. And that's because the algorithms are trying to figure out who we are and what we're going to click on. It's the same as when you watch a YouTube video and you get another one recommended and then one recommended after that. And once you're three or four recommendations in, you're invariably at something crazy violent, crazy sexy, crazy ISIS, crazy anti-vax. You know, it's going to be the weirdest conspiratorial stuff. The whole of the internet is tilting towards crazy. And that's because the crazier the thing is, the more you're going to be pushed into your reptile brain, the more you're going to panic, the more you're going to click on it, the stupider you're going to be. If everything you're getting recommended is more reasonable, more reasoned, more intelligent, then it's like a teacher might be, oh, if you liked that book, maybe you'll like Charles Dickens, you know, or maybe you'll like, you know, Jane Austen or something. You know, you're going to like this, you know, and it's trying to up people's game. It's business. It's let's get people to click on stuff by any means necessary. And it so turns out that these algorithmic engines have discovered that the more upset you make people, the more polarized you make them, the more you can push them into their reptilian fight or flight responses, the more they're going to click. And that's actually a problem for government. That's what's gotten us. That's what's gotten us Trump. And the government, or at least the government that would be working with Google on you know, deep questions of deep state, is not the Trump government. You know, it's much more the Bush-Clinton government that's doing that. And that's a problem, too. I mean, it's not really good what they were doing either.
They want to manipulate elections.
Right, but the Trump situation is not about manipulating elections so much, I think, at least when they're the way they're talking about it, so much as, gosh, we should try to create a landscape in which people consider reading. We should try to have a landscape in which people aren't pushed towards the most extreme kind of fake news nuttiness, whether they're on the right or on the left. And the algorithms that are driving our social media feeds or that are driving our search results want to get us to crazy as quickly as possible. So I do think that, you know, Facebook or Google have a point that if they were engineered differently, they might not be encouraging people to hate. They might not be encouraging people towards racism and extremism and all that. Whether it's true, whether by refusing to be broken up, they will be more adept at preventing these scenarios, that's a whole other question. Personally, I don't trust Facebook to regulate itself. You know, I understand they don't want to be regulated. I understand they're afraid to be broken up because their business model depends to some extent on their monopoly. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that, you know, as talk of breaking up Facebook kind of surfaced, what did we see Facebook do? First, they said we're going to bundle all of our various social messaging applications together, really just to make it harder to pry us apart and break us up. And second, what did they say? Oh, we're going to invent a currency. We're inventing the Libra. You know, to me, the Libra, which is sort of their blockchain effort, is a bargaining chip. I think that's their way of saying, look, if you try to break us up, we're going to screw up the U.S. dollar. You know, we're going to this could get really scary for all y'all. Or you know, even if they don't build or use it as a blackmail that way, they could say, okay, now we have the Libra. Do you want us to keep the Libra based on the U.S. dollar? Or should we go base it on an international basket of currencies? Or base it on the Chinese currency? In other words, if Libra really is a currency that could be used by billions of people on Facebook, then the U.S. government really will want whatever this is, based on the U.S. dollar and not something else. So what I'm looking at is, you know, these companies making any argument they can prevent themselves from being broken up. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know. I'm not such an expert in monopoly law to understand exactly what the impact would be if we broke them up. But personally, I'm kind of more in favor of ongoing regulation. I think in some ways they'll be easier to control as a single entity than as, you know, 1,000 little brooms of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Each one, you know, a tiny 1,000 Facebooks is sort of like being attacked by piranhas instead of one shark.
good visual, Douglas. Yeah, I could totally see that. Yeah, I could totally see that happening. Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, is referenced in the Speed of Money section of the book, Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus. I mention this because of your tie-in of expansionist economy with climate change. Based on the decade-long work and research of past guests discussing real-time climate engineering, a good example of costly fixes is happening right now. Researcher Dane Wigington has shown that the current wildfires out west are strategically placed to cast a solar radiation management across the continent and the Arctic. Sacrificing forests to fix a potential man-made climate disruption is right in line with this formula. What are your thoughts on this, Douglas?
Now, do you mean strategically placed by humans?
Correct. He's got flight paths of aircraft going over certain forests, and these were the locations where the forest fires were taking place.
And these are like the fires, like the Hannah Montana losing her house in Malibu fires, had to get private firefighters. I thought it was all climate change making these fires.
Right. That's what we have been told. But there's something even deeper going on that a lot of people have been examining and researching for over a decade and bringing it forth and bringing it forward. But it's often squelched by the labels of climate change denier. Because what these people are bringing forward, and I agree with them, is that geoengineering, the climate engineering technology, is being deployed in real time right now. The crisis has already occurred, but there's this masquerade that it hasn't happened yet and we got to be prepared for it, but it's happening right now in real time.
Right, but I agree with climate change that, but how do we know that that geoengineering is happening, and who would even be doing it? Is this like George Soros or the Koch brothers or Trump? I mean, Trump doesn't even believe in climate change.
These are super secret operations that are occurring, and the military, private companies, you know, the defense contractors, it's part of the war machine, because this is part of weather warfare.
It's weather warfare against climate change. It's good weather warfare being done by bad people in secret ways.
It's a really good point there. You would think that because if there was something benevolent here, they would be the first to call attention to it. But I think it's more sinister. And I think something is worse than they're letting on, because they're keeping very quiet about this. And the people who are paying attention, such as Dane Wigington at Geoengineering Watch, has shown visual evidence that they're sacrificing the forest to fix a potential man-made climate disruption. And it's in line with the formulas that you've presented. That's why I wanted to bring this up.
If the analysis was done that these fires are beautifully and strategically placed to prevent some kind of climate changey thing, I'd be more likely to believe that Gaia, the Earth's consciousness, is protecting itself from climate change, you know, in an as yet not understood planetary logic, than the U.S. government is actually capable of not only figuring this out, but executing it.
I hear you on that, and I'm thinking about the research that has been marginalized and suppressed in not only the mainstream media, but also countered by propaganda across all media. You know, this level of research and understanding that this is an ongoing thing is eclipsed by the climate change push. You know, the 360.org people and on, they call the people who are researching the real-time geoengineering crazy and conspiracy theorists. And that's been going on for a long time. And I just think that it's got to come out. It will come out. And you hit upon the model of why this geoengineering would be going on in real time, because of the costly fixes that you've exposed and talked about in your book. I thought, wow, that's right in line with geoengineering. I wasn't sure how, if you knew about this, if you considered it real or not, but I'm glad I can bring it to your attention. And
yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of different pieces to parse. So one of them is, yes, big corporations love costly fixes to our social and environmental problems. So big, you know, Monsanto on a certain level loves the depletion of topsoil because then it makes us more dependent on Monsanto solutions for trying to grow vegetables in dead soil, right? So, oh, good, there's a market for that. And there's more money is made when you're dependent on a Monsanto to grow stuff than if you can just put seeds in the ground and grow it a normal, old-fashioned way. So GDP goes up when bad things cost money. If you get cancer, GDP goes up because you've got to buy chemo. So then you're saying that, okay, so there's a push for these giant geoengineering projects because they're going to cost a lot of money. If that were the case, then I would think what they want to do is large, very public geoengineering projects so that all this tax money can go to them without it being sort of clandestine budget stuff going there. But you're saying on top of that, on top of the bias for large geothermal projects that use a lot of money in order to increase GDP and allow us to continue economic growth,
geoengineering.
They want to do it in
geoengineering. Okay.
Right. I'm just thinking that if the economic argument was the main thing, then there's plenty of more expensive ways to do things. They should, you know, shoot the sulfur in the sky and the iron filings in the ocean. You know, there are all those things. It's really tricky. I mean, I guess what you'd be saying is, okay, so there's, you know, some big corporation, Monsanto or McDonnell Douglas, that has kind of a secret deal with the Pentagon or with the DOD, and they're getting money that it says it's just for some line item, but it really is doing this kind of climate change remediation because in reality, the Pentagon believes, as I know they do, that if climate change is not dealt with, then we're going to have social unrest on an order we've never seen before. So there is a national defense issue with preventing climate change, and I could see them wanting to do it secretly to avoid panic, right? So let's do some climate change remediation without telling people we're doing it, because if we tell them we're doing it, then they're really going to know that climate change is on its way. But I would love to see some of the actual evidence as well as why our best investigative journalists are not interested in it. You know, why the ProPublica and other networks don't see this when they're capable of uncovering, you know, global economic conspiracies of billionaires, why they can't see this one.
Yes, and it's the opposite. I think a lot of editors in these organizations have learned to think that anybody talking about this is crazy or just conspiracy-minded. That mind virus, if you will, has been let out into society. A journalist might bring it up to an editor. I think it's suppressed. Isn't that fake? Isn't that the mantra of alt-right? You know, because I've heard that as well.
Well, I mean, it's still, all you need is one whistleblower. All you need is one Snowden, one, you know, person sending something to WikiLeaks. I mean, I'll ask the DOD people I know. I'll call and say, I want to help. You know, how can I help? I know propaganda. I teach it. I write books about it. I can do all the evil. You know, and I'll go in all ready to help geo stuff and see if anybody points me toward the thing.
Definitely. Okay. Well, Douglas Rushkoff, I'm glad we got to talk about climate change and climate engineering. There are many great suggestions you've provided in helping to rewrite the program of the business as usual operating system running quietly in the background. Would you talk about some of them for listeners, please?
Yeah, I mean, they're really pretty easy. I mean, one is just changing your basic business model from make everyone else bankrupt to make everyone else rich. You know, what businesses are slowly realizing now is if you make everybody in your marketplace bankrupt, if you take all their money, they don't have money to spend with you. You know, so really what you want is your customers to get rich by working with you, with your partners to get rich, your employees to get rich. What you want to do is circulate money around so everybody is getting wealthy and has money to spend with you, rather than looking at everybody else as a competitor from whom you want to take all their money. You know, the big problem that corporations face today is they're all really fat. They all took all the money off the table. They don't know how to deploy their assets. So that's one way to think about it. I mean, another is just don't grow your business larger than it has to be in order to do its job. That's called subsidiarity. And the idea is you grow your business till it's functional. You never have to grow for growth's sake. You know, the only reason you would have to do that is if you borrowed a whole lot of money and need to keep paying back more money and keep growing. But most people aren't even happy doing that. When you go from being the person who makes the pizzas to being the manager of a pizza chain, often it's not as much fun. It's not doing the thing that you actually do, you know, and you shouldn't have to do that just to be financially solvent. You know, there's a lot of these, you know, and I list them all in various places in the Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus book, but really what it has, they all in one way or another have to do with moving from a growth-based understanding of the economy to a flow-based understanding of the economy. So it's not how much money can I take out of the system and store in the freezer, and rather, how do I get money circulating? How do I optimize my business for value creation and exchange? How do I share my trade secrets with others? You know, how do I increase my competency rather than just my bank account? How do I learn to trust other people? How do I look at my community, not as the people I'm going to have to fight with, but the people who are going to support me in my old age? How do I run my company more like a family business rather than a shareholder-owned business? So I'm thinking not how can I extract money to give my grandchildren, but how can I build a business that my grandchildren would want to work in? You know, and that's a mindset. It's a long-term mindset in business and economics that we need to adopt if we want to survive for the long term.
Throwing Rocks at the Google Bus, How Growth Became the Enemy of Prosperity, a real fantastic book, another great book. Douglas Rushkoff, thank you so much for being on In Other News.
Well, thanks for having me on and giving me new rabbit holes to explore.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.